Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Adam, welcome to History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you today nearly live from Toronto, Ontario. We're here for the 2014 Berks Conference. And earlier today, I had the chance to speak with Vereen Shepherd from the University of the West Indies, and I was really excited to talk to her. When I was an undergraduate student, I did an exchange to the University of the West Indies in Barbados, and because she's such a luminary figure in Caribbean history, I read a lot of her stuff and got really familiar with her work, and this is the first opportunity that I had to meet her because she's a professor at the campus in Jamaica, the Mona campus, and I was at Cave Hill in Barbados, so this is a really exciting chance for me. And I think it's a great episode. It's a little shorter than our normal shows, and that's because we were sort of chased out of the room we were in because there was a panel starting. And you can sort of hear during the show that it gets a little louder in the background. That's because more and more people started to come in. But I took it as long as I could, and it's a conversation I could have gone a lot longer with, but I very much enjoyed it. So here it is, my conversation from earlier today with Vereen Shepherd. Vereen Shepherd, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing this. Yeah. This is very exciting for me, I have to say. Very rarely on this show have I ever been really starstruck. But it's how often do you have to get to talk to someone whose books you've read over however many years?
Talking to your source.
Yeah, this is it's very very exciting for me.
Talking to your source.
Yeah. So I just saw your panel. It was a terrific discussion of representations of women in the Caribbean historiography. And one of the things I noticed when I was at the University of the West Indies at the Cave Hill campus was that it seemed to me that there was a small c conservative attitude towards women and homosexuals in particular. And I'm wondering if that's something that's regional or if it's something that is part of maybe a colonial path. I'm just wondering what the origins of that attitude is.
I think it could be part of just how our children are socialized, how all of us in the Caribbean have been socialized. And it's the power of the Christianity, the missionary education that we got. I think that is the root of it. I think that gradually people are being more exposed to other lifestyles, other sexualities. But the conservatism that you detected when you were an undergraduate, I think, has to do with how everybody was trained, and the origin of schools and the philosophy of education and the content of the books. Most of our schools started by missionaries, and the content was and the orientation was towards Christian right. And so I think that's what we have inherited, but it's changing.
Right. Is it been a slower process than elsewhere in the world? Because it really struck me as very different from Canada.
Yes. I think, because the syllabus changes slowly and people's worldview change slowly. But the good thing is that it is changing. Whatever the pace, it is changing. You do have a very, very strong Christian attitude towards alternative lifestyles. But, you know, as I said, there's more tolerance now, much more tolerance.
Right. Mm-hmm. Was there, because most of the courses I did when I was there was slavery and right after emancipation, maybe up until the wars, the world wars. Nothing really post Second World War. So I'm wondering because in the Caribbean, do you see the same type of women's movements in the 50s, 60s, 70s? Or do they sort of get lost in the independence movements that you see throughout the region in that period? And is that perhaps a reason why those issues don't get addressed in the same way? Because you're addressing the national issues that are so prominent.
In fact, many of the early... I think our feminist movement was later. I think we were much more caught up in decolonization. I think you're right about that. But in the 30s, 40s, 50s, you did have women like Una Marson, Emma Bailey, talking about women's rights and actually being influenced by the suffragette movement and the civil rights movement, which also talked about women's rights and so on. But and then when you talk to some of these early feminists, they say that they suspended their feminist activism in search of independence to join with men in the independence project. And then the men promised them that at the end of all of this, when independence was achieved, they would return to the feminist agenda.
Right.
Some women say that took long to happen. Mm-hmm. And it was only in the 70s, actually, that women were able to influence the political system to pay attention to women's rights. Mm-hmm. For example, maternity leave with pay, you know, equal wage for equal work, and so on. Mm-hmm. So the feminist movement started late. Decolonization was the big issue. Mm-hmm. And then a return to the feminist agenda. Mm. And that agenda has continued to grow.
So in comparison then to what we see in North America, at least, there's a different timeline.
It's a different timeline, yes.
Now, one of the things we talked about in this panel was how children are taught and how there's not really discussion of gender issues in schools in the region. And how that affects people moving forward, and particularly boys. And you said specifically that boys are taught, whether it's a conscious on teachers or not, that their role is to be public figures and to lead. And women are taught that
they
your role is domestic.
Yes. Their place is in the house, but not the House of Representatives.
Right, yeah. And how dangerous that is.
Yeah, it is dangerous.
And so I'm wondering then how do, and this was a question that was asked during the panel, I mean, how do girls overcome this if this is what they're taught when they're starting when they're 5 years old?
Good question. It's a good question. But let me return to something you said earlier. The textbooks, the writing, the scholarly writing has also advanced, you know. In other words, you were doing a lot of slavery history, apprenticeship, post-emancipation, and so on. But you have scholars who are now writing about political history, the role of men and women in the decolonization movement. There's business history. We're now moving away from the sugar economy and looking at, you know, diversification. So there's a lot more happening in the historiography now than perhaps, you know, 10 years ago.
Right.
The movement is advancing. We have landscape history. You know, you have surveys that are being done. You have a lot of oral history. So even the methodology and the sources for the study of history have also advanced.
Right.
With much more oral history. Mm-hmm. And we have a return to subaltern history that is trying to capture the voices of men and women. But, you know, I use a parallel with the civil rights movement, with emancipation and so on. When a group, whether they're a numerical minority or not, but when a group is marginalized, they seek ways of coming out of this marginalization. And so girls have seized the opportunities of education to get jobs, more empowering jobs with more decent wage and so on. So women, because of their subordination historically, have found ways, as enslaved people found ways to come out of slavery.
Right.
But men are not doing that because they claim power. And in many cases, the uneducated men or boys can find jobs in the society.
Right.
Some of them through family, through family wealth or whatever. They don't have to do all that well in school. And also men have a wide variety of avenues to, you know, get money. So they are not, I think education for men is too slow a process for upward social mobility.
Okay.
But for women, education is really like, you know, sort of only way to do this. And they have seized it in large numbers.
Right.
And now there's a backlash. Because women are saying, but where is the educated man for me, you know? Or where is the educated person for me? And so this is part of the backlash. And that's why I made a connection between what the education system is like, what are the ideologies, and the attitude, the treatment of women in the family.
Right.
And I made a link to gender-based violence. Because if you think someone is inferior and you have power over them, and if you resent their progress up the social ladder, it's going to come out in unsociable behavior.
Right. And you read a quote that sounded like something from 1850.
Well, it was just this year.
It's crazy. Like,
because what's happening now is that one of our young senators, Imani Duncan Price, has introduced a motion in the Senate to have quotas in the Senate and in Parliament, quotas of women, mm-hmm. to have more gender balance in government. Mm-hmm. And there's been a backlash from men who feel that this is giving women a free pass and is going to encourage uneducated and unfit people to be in Parliament. And they don't realize that there are so many qualified women. You will never have that.
Right.
But also, the idea that he doesn't believe in gender equality, because patriarchy is very strong.
Right.
And that's what he's reflecting.
Yeah, and one of the things you said in that quote, or that you quoted, mm-hmm. he said, like, if naturally men and women aren't equal.
Yes, he feels that we are subverting what is a natural order.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well,
I mean, obviously
there are men who believe that.
Like, obviously there are physical differences between men and women, mm-hmm. sure, but mm-hmm. to suggest that a lack of equality
is... It's a real backward idea, and it's amazing how many men have come out of the woodworks to express these sentiments just because they feel threatened by female power,
right.
you know? And yet women are not claiming power. They are claiming a position where they can be of use. They're not saying we're going to then go into Parliament and exercise power over men.
Right.
But it's interesting that in this discourse, in this public discourse, we're holding men and women to different standards because there are many uneducated men politicians.
Sure.
There are many incapable male politicians, inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, they all see the entry of women as a way of giving women a free pass and that you'll have unsuitable women. That's not so. Right. Women are qualified.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the question I would have about a quota system is that, is it possible to have a quota for people who are elected? I mean, because ultimately it's up
good
to the people, right? I mean, you could have a quota for each party in terms of...
But you could do it in the Senate because it's an appointed, a nominated House.
Yeah. Yes. It's a little harder to do it...
In the House of Parliament. So there are three ways that countries have treated this. One, they have reserve seats.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they address the issue at the level of the political parties.
Right.
And thirdly, they could say, you know, they have to have the balance in Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
But in the first-past-the-post system, you're absolutely right. It's much more difficult. Mm-hmm. So in Australia and Ireland and places like these, what they're doing is to address it at the level of the party.
Right.
To say, of all the people who are going to, we are going to put up for election, you must have 50-50.
Okay.
And but you could still get a gender imbalance.
Sure.
Because many societies, even though women are 51% of, say, the population in Jamaica, and the majority of voters are women, they're not necessarily voting gender.
Right.
You see? So we'll see. But CEDAW calls for it.
Mm-hmm.
The National Policy for Gender Equality in Jamaica calls for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the post-2015 agenda is calling for it. So, and some countries have moved that way. We know Rwanda is leading. South Africa also has this policy, the ANC. So we have to look at best practices and see what we want to pattern in Jamaica.
Yeah. It would be really interesting if it was in the party system. And,
yes.
And then each party, I don't know if this would happen, but if patriarchy is so ingrained that each party agrees that we'll have a man against a woman in each
constituency.
And just to see what happens,
right.
if they would set that up.
Yes. Well, the good thing is that the government has put together a subcommittee to debate the quota issue.
Mm.
So they are saying we're taking it seriously, and we have a subcommittee of Parliament to debate this and to come back to the Parliament with recommendations. Yeah. So we'll see how that goes. Mm.
And you wonder, too, if sometimes you hear of backlash to affirmative action in the United States. And some people who are against it argue that, well, someone gets a shot who doesn't deserve it.
Right.
And I would assume that similar things would be lobbied if there's a quota system.
Yes, yes. But what they're missing in this opposition is that you have more qualified women than qualified men.
Right.
So you'll never have a situation where you don't have qualified women.
Sure.
You know?
Well, I know, like, for me, at the University of the West Indies, when I was there, granted, I was there in 2005, 2006, there were more than one class where I was the only man in the class.
Yes.
So at least from my anecdotal experience, more women are being educated at the highest level
in the
region than men are. And
you
would think that those are the people who you want in these leadership positions.
Exactly. But even though women are almost everywhere now, the ideology hasn't caught up.
Right.
That they have a right to be there. This is what we're fighting in the Caribbean right now.
Okay.
We have won the battle against class oppression, against race oppression. We have not won the battle against gender oppression and women's subordination. We haven't won that battle. And therefore, what you have is a that is why you can have the perspective that I read in my paper today.
Right. I guess one of the other questions that we would have to ask is, in the region, from your perspective, is there still lingering racial tensions that is an undercurrent to these gender issues as well? We talk about slavery. From my learnings on slavery, there was obviously there was gender elements to it, and that women were subjugated even further, particularly in sexual context.
Right.
And does that continue to play a role even 150 years since the end of slavery?
In Jamaica, not so much. No. So I think, though, that classism has replaced racism as a means of, oppression.
Yeah.
So you could have a working class woman who then has multiple forms of oppression, suffers multiple forms of discrimination on the basis of class, could be on the basis of skin color, which is quite strong as well.
Yep.
But all these are legacies of slavery, and we're slowly getting rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
So racism is not as strong in the Caribbean, but classism is very strong.
Right.
And we often say that racism masks itself as classism.
Mm.
So you do have lingering issues
right.
of that nature in the Caribbean. Yeah.
Well, because I tell the story a lot. When I was there, I had a professor, Pedro Welch, who I'm sure you know.
Yes, I know.
I had him every day I was there. I had two courses with him each semester.
Mm-hmm.
So every single day I went to class. Mm-hmm. One of his was his classes. And towards the end of the year, I was in an American history course.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we were talking about affirmative action. He said, we should all know what affirmative action is because we're all black.
Mm-hmm.
And then he immediately looked at me and said, except you.
Mm-hmm.
And I told that story at the closing banquet for the residents, which is a majority black audience. And everybody laughed. It's a funny story. It wasn't meant offensively. I come home and I tell that story to predominantly white audiences.
I'm not sure you can tell it in this context.
People are taken aback by it.
Yes,
and they don't
think
it's funny. And they think, if anything, it might be kind of offensive. And so it strikes me that...
Yeah.
Clearly skin color doesn't seem to play as much of a role. When I can tell that story in the Caribbean, no one cares, and here people are.
I think it's because we laugh at ourselves a lot.
Mm.
We know that there are problems, but we make jokes of them all the time, even though we know that there are underlying social problems.
Right.
And we see this coming out, for example, in the relationship, let's say in Guyana and Trinidad and Tobago, we have large populations of Asians. And in Jamaica, where you also have a small population of Asians, including Indians and Chinese, but we are educated enough to know you don't make racial jokes.
Right.
You know, you don't use the C word.
Sure.
And and so on.
Sure.
So, but there's a tendency, people, in terms of economic competition, you could have those tensions emerging.
Right.
They're like buried, but they could emerge
at
any moment of crisis.
Mm.
But it's not as... I mean, I wouldn't have said that sort of thing.
Right.
Even the Caribbean.
Yeah.
You know? But then some people, will just laugh at themselves about issues like those.
Yeah. Mm. Well, it struck me too with the guys who I was living with in Res that it was sort of like, sure, there's a difference in skin color. Mm. Let's at least acknowledge that there is a difference in skin color.
Yes, yes.
And in doing so, we acknowledge that it doesn't really mean anything.
But it means a lot. I mean, in Jamaica, shadism is a big problem.
Yeah.
Because there is discrimination on the basis of skin color.
Okay.
And that is why the bleaching, skin bleaching, is going on, and it is so rampant. Because young men, young women, not so much the men, but young women, feel as if they can't get a job uptown. You know, in what we call uptown, in the banks and, insurance companies and so on, if they don't dress a certain way and if they don't look a certain way.
Okay.
And so many of them are, they are saying it's not about not being proud to be black.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the reality of life. I want a job and I want a certain kind of job. I don't want to be confined to a certain kind of job, say in the inner city and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I want a job uptown. But I can't give my address as below crossroads, and I have to have a kind of skin shade
okay.
to be acceptable by uptown society.
Wow.
And so this is what is happening. So skin color does matter. Maybe in Barbados,
yeah.
there's more sort of homogeneity. In terms of that, the black community.
Yeah. yeah. But and granted, it's a very anecdotal thing. It's me and 10
yes,
other guys,
yes,
right?
Yes, so. I know. But I think it's also maybe a reflection of a larger issue in the Barbadian society where it's more black-white rather than intra-black.
Right.
You know? But
right.
In Jamaica, you have this legacy of slavery where they used to categorize the population
right.
according to African, Sambo, Mulatto, Mustafini, Octoroon,
yeah.
and that sort of thing. And in the Spanish Caribbean, they had many more categories and
yeah.
shades. So we do have a problem there.
Yeah, yeah, that's one of the things that I was really struck by when I was there, too. The the language that's used, like the term colored, which
yes.
is something that
yes.
growing up I never encountered.
Right, right.
And yet it's a
yes.
it's a category historically
yeah.
that people
yeah.
found themselves in.
But no, we only use it if we're talking about history, though.
Yeah, sure,
I don't
sure,
think
sure, sure.
we use it in the society.
No.
And I tend to tell students, use mixed race,
right.
you know, rather than colored and
yeah.
stuff like that.
Yeah.
But in the Caribbean now, they use, people use mulatto very loosely.
Mm-hmm.
And in Jamaica, they use the term browning.
Right.
You know, this is a term now in Jamaica.
Right.
You're a browning,
yeah.
meaning you're mixed race.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, is that part too? It's a debate that happens in the United States that I pay somewhat attention to because it happens in sports a lot with
yes.
the N-word.
Yes.
Where younger generations of African Americans use it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the arguments is that they use it because they don't understand the power of it that their parents and their grandparents
That's
do because
right.
it was used against them.
Yes.
And now
yes.
these, and again, particularly young men are using this almost as a term of affection within
yeah.
each other
yeah.
because they don't understand the power.
Right,
of
but
it.
You don't dare, as an outsider, use it though.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course.
So that means they know that it can be offensive.
Right.
If they didn't know that, then anybody could use it.
Sure.
But they do know, you know, that. But it's a kind of way of claiming an identity and having an inner circle that others don't have access to.
Mm-hmm.
And but I don't encourage it myself, you know. I think it's offensive.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe by itself it's okay, but when you put it within context, then it's not okay.
Right.
And so I don't encourage anybody to use it. Mm. And I certainly wouldn't use it. And if anybody uses it to me, I will object.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure. Mm. I want to get back to you talked about women in Jamaica lightening their skin in an
yeah.
effort to get jobs. Obviously, this, I would assume, ties back to then this gender issue.
It goes back to slavery rather than... It goes back to slavery, and it goes back to the post-colonial legacies of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
During slavery, skin color mattered, and
yeah.
race mattered. In the post-slavery Caribbean, those who took over Caribbean society continued the mentalities of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when the economy opened up, when, you know, you had the sort of businesses opening up
mm-hmm.
and the tourism industry opening up, the front desk people they wanted were mixed race women, never wanted black girls because again the legacy of slavery is very strong and is a negative attitude to blackness
right.
and so it's taken its own time to come out of our society. So you'll see in the professions, because nobody's going to not give me a job as a professor because
right.
I'm a black woman,
right?
But where you have front desk jobs like in the tourist industry, in the banks, insurance companies, and there was a time when if they couldn't find a mixed race woman with long hair, processed hair,
yeah.
they would find Chinese or Indian woman, you know, when they had a choice.
Right.
So black women have had to struggle very hard for respect and respectability.
Right. And so at two different levels then.
Yes.
Because we talked about this, there's not as many opportunities for women, just in general.
Yeah.
And then add on this other element.
At the upper level.
Right.
At the,
yeah. So, and then add on this other element.
Yes.
And it's oppression from all directions.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so moving forward, because we
yes.
there's another panel coming
yes.
in, so we're going to have
yes.
to leave. I could do this all day because I think this is so interesting.
Yes.
But so moving forward, you know, you talked about how, in terms of the textbooks, you're not getting a lot of responses from education ministries. I mean, how do you go about addressing these issues regionally in a way to address this oppression and hopefully overcome it?
Yeah. Well, we're going to continue to have teacher workshops. And we're going to, as historians, review books and publish the reviews.
Yeah.
And at the Institute for Gender and Development Studies, we're going to continue to lobby the ministers of education. We're going to go to CARICOM, which is a regional political body to see if that will help. And we'll continue with our Caribbean associations to write letters and so on, and hopefully to get change. I think there's a slow change. In Jamaica, I met the Minister of Education recently, and he said, "I've heard you, I've heard you." So that's a small encouragement. Mm-hmm. And also, we're encouraging our historians to become public figures, public historians.
Right.
I now have a program on radio called Talking History.
Oh, great.
And I use that program to advance the issues that I think are important and to teach history to a wider public, since history is not a mandatory subject in school. Yeah. So it's one thing to criticize the textbooks and say what is not in the textbook, but even if you should have a perfect textbook, who is reading them?
Right.
History is not mandatory, and the number of students taking history is shrinking. So we're and what we're encouraging is for different countries, and I've seen some good news so far. Different countries are picking up my program. And also creating space in their own country for such programs.
Okay.
So historians are on the warpath in terms of trying to destabilize and to overcome the difficulties that we have, because history matters.
Yes.
And it can shape and transform society.
Yeah.
If our children don't have access to that, then they're never going to understand. Those young boys that you see going around calling themselves nigger and blah, blah, a lot of them don't have the information. They have never studied history. Maybe they don't have parents who are passing down the struggle because they don't want to, you know, oppress them with that information so that they can go forward as self-confident beings and not have the baggage. So historians have to be activists in the cause of Caribbean development.
And just the radio show, would it be available? Is it online too?
Yes, in fact, it just happened.
It just aired right now?
Yes, okay. Just aired right now. You can pick it up on Nationwide 90FM.
Okay.
So at 9 o'clock in Jamaica every Saturday morning, just go online and look for Nationwide 90FM and you'll pick it up.
All right,
yes,
terrific.
It's called Talking History.
All right, I like it. Terrific. Reen Shepherd, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
If you have any questions, comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com, Twitter @DrShawneeFever, and if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.